is the third in a series of discussions about African traditional religions and cultures. The subtitle of this third session is Community. We have in the earlier two sessions dealt with topics relating to creation and to health. And it's been the attempt to try to take some look at traditional African religions and cultures, and we've tried to put them together to emphasize the fact that for Africans in their traditional ways, religion was never simply an individual matter or a personal matter, but always in relation to cultural events, to societal events, to events of family and clan and tribe, always together. And we saw how, for those of you who are not with in some of the other previous sessions, how these expressions of religion and culture have taken forms that are almost always oral, for one thing, pre-literate, always having a good amount of music involved, and also music in a corporate sense. We saw a lot of these things relating to health as the center part of this these discussions, and seeing how in traditional religions health is almost always a vital part of the religion and the culture, relating to people's health or the lack of it, or the attempts to cure it, in relationship to people that we often wrongly call witch doctors, and seeing it in terms of a religion that we also wrongly call animism. Animism is one part of traditional African religions, meaning that everything is animated by spirit. It's certainly a vital part of those religions, but it would be somewhat wrong for us to take and say that the religion is animism. It involves more than that. But those are some comments from some of our previous sessions. Today we want to look at the sense of community in African traditional religions and cultures, and how that discussion and some of those topics again might relate to our understanding of Christianity, and help us to see how Christianity has grown and flourished so remarkably in the African continent, and where there might be some conflicts between those traditional beliefs and what we know of as Christian beliefs. As we do this today, we talk about community, mainly would like to see it in terms of rites of passage, where the effects and the emphasis upon community most often is expressed. The rites of passage that relate to birth and to movement into puberty and a marriage, and even rites of passage, the ultimate passage, I suppose, of death, and how community, the sense of it, fits into all of that. One of the basic underlying statements of this understanding would have to be that the identity of a person in the African context comes from the community. That a person is a person because of his membership, because of his being a part of something or some group, whether it's family or clan or tribe, those three most predominantly. The concept of individualism, which is so much a dominant underlying force in our culture, and even in our practice of Christianity, is a bit strange to the African in his traditional ways. In fact, individualism, whereas it's held as a value by us, quite often would be considered as an example of selfishness by people who live within a culture where the good of the whole is more important than the good of individuals. Some examples, and I mentioned this one last week, I don't think many of you were here, in another context, in another series, of showing how the sense of being with people is so important to Africans. It's one of the things that people always comment when they visit Africa is how there are people everywhere. And there are always people together on the road. Sometimes the roads are full of people traffic, along with their donkeys and goats and whatnot, that makes movement a bit tough. You will see them working together, singing together, women cooking together. It would be strange for an African woman to be boxed up in a modern kitchen all by yourself, fixing a meal, in all that isolation. I mean, that would be depressing to be in that, you know, even with running tap water, and they probably would get convinced with that, rather than having to walk a mile or two for the water and carrying it on their head. But even with the conveniences, the thought of fixing food and a meal by yourself would be very, very strange. It's one of the culture shocks and adjustments that Africans have in coming to this country when they come to study or for other purposes, because you would see them much more often doing the cooking together, pounding grain or preparing the food or working and talking, which has a bit of attractiveness, I think, when you think of it, to do that together. We had two Ethiopian refugees living with us for a year, a few years ago, and one of them particularly, who had quite recently come out of a traditional, more primitive village, and into our sort of suburban setting and high school. You know, I can imagine the culture shock that he had going the way he did. But if he would come home from school and no one was home, you could almost count on him being depressed to be in the house alone. You know, most of us long for that now and then, especially when we've had a hard day or been with people. We like our solitude. And for him, I think it was somewhat typical of an African understanding, is that when people began to gather and there was noise and comments and things, then he was, you know, you could see his spirits lifting. We had one of them graduated from high school while they lived with us, and we wanted to have a traditional Ethiopian feast to celebrate as a community and invite all the Ethiopians that were living in the whole area to come. And you know, he wanted to kill a goat in our backyard and a few other things which may not have gone over so well with the municipal authorities, but they did cook all day and all night in our kitchen, and it was, you know, it was a mess, but they had a great time, and it was a real corporate activity of preparing that food. Houses, as you see pictures of a typical African village, are quite often in a circle. And very often the care of children and people within that, in that kind of collective living, is done very cooperatively. The fact of hiring a babysitter would be somewhat strange to people living in an extended family setting of a village of homes and of people living very closely together. This kind of corporate family identity carries over into politics. Most African countries have a one-party state, and we sometimes look at that askance and say, how can you really have any kind of voice of the people when there's only one party? But there have been African leaders who have talked about it in terms of the nation being a family. And it sounds a bit sexist, but then there's a lot of chauvinism in Africa. A family can only have one father, and a country can only have one father. And it makes as much sense to have multiplicity of parties and contending views in one country as it does to have a multiplicity of fathers in one house with contending views. You have contending views within the family, but you have one head in a very, most cases, a patriarchal system. And in that sense, the one-party state makes sense in their culture in a very real way. Look at some of the effects of this sense of community, of a person having worth as a person by being part of a community. One of the main ways of ostracizing someone, punishing someone from participation, from the community, is to push them out. I think if we were to do it in the way we treat our kids, if they're misbehaving, you know, go to your room, is in a sense a kind of ostracizing, but maybe what we would do if we were to follow this practice is to kick them out of the house, where they aren't surrounded by any people or surroundings of things that are accustomed to them. And the ultimate punishment of an African would be to be moved out or kicked out or ostracized from a community, or to lose face within a community would be also a tragic happening. Many of the more than 800 African languages are really governed by proverbs in the way that teaching takes place. And there are many common proverbs that seem to flow between different tribes and language groups. And one of them that appears very often is a proverb to the effect that you are not human by yourself. That to be human, you must be with others. And in many languages, it has a real poetic ring. Most of the African languages being oral, and the proverbs having rhyme and beauty in the way the words are put together. It would be a way that a mother or a father would teach children, would be by proverbs. And I think interesting that through many of them are ideas that build on the fact that you are human because you are part of a community. In another political way that this has been carried forward is in Tanzania, where Julius Nyerere established what he called African socialism and established Ujamaa, which is a Swahili word for common humanity. Ujamaa villages, in which people are brought together and live in a collective kind of way. That was his attempt at institutionalizing or taking a prevalent fact of African life and making of it an institution, an Ujamaa village, which brought people together into a somewhat arbitrary village. Let's look at some things related to birth. And it's difficult to talk about any of these customs in a way that goes over all African religions and cultures, but there's some similarities that at least persist among many of them. The birth of a child is something that's received with great joy. The announcement of of pregnancy or the coming of a child is something of community joy, as well as something for the mother and father. The society really has its purpose of creating that child into the society. In most cases, the idea of the nuclear family is something quite foreign, as we practice it, whereas parents, we have responsibility for raising these children, they're ours, and then we have to take the knocks when they do poorly, and somehow we try to build ourselves up when they do fairly well, but all within a kind of this nuclear, you know, some help from brothers and uncles and sisters and grandmas and grandpas, but the nuclear family, as we understand it, is quite foreign in traditional ways, and therefore the responsibility for protecting and feeding and caring for and educating the child is the community's. There was at a recent missionary conference that we had one of the families there with young children, and they had come from a more traditional society, traditional place, and they had a hard time getting accustomed to the fact that they had to watch their kids in America. I mean, they've been gone 3 years or something, you become acclimated to a new place, the kids go free, somebody's always there to take care of them, to watch over them. You know, it's sort of like Holden in a way. I mean, we have teenagers here and we haven't seen them since we got off the boat a week and a half ago almost. It's, where can they go in the one sense? And you kind of trust everybody else here, that people are here with a certain kind of moral outlook on life or whatever. I mean, I don't know if we can trust everybody. I don't know if you can trust me, but we have this sense about it here, I think, that, you know, the kids kind of go. We know they aren't going to wander too far in the woods or whatever. But this person said that it was a real frustration for her to go, for example, into a supermarket or into a shopping mall and have all of these reminders on milk cartons or whatever of missing children, of children being kidnapped, of watching your kids, of going to school, walking home with them so that kidnappers aren't there to take your kids. The fear that was created in just a few months being back in this country and a real longing to return to that kind of society where there was a community where they knew as the kids ran about that they would be cared for, and there was a sense that the child was a child of the community. I don't know how we can recreate that, given our culture and society, but it's one of the places, I think, where there is something that we can learn. And I, in giving this series, what I've been trying to do is prompt us to see that we can be the learners, and we need to be the learners from those people that we have considered pagan and primitive and all other kinds of pejorative terms, in terms of society and also in terms of religion, that there's a lot of contributions that they are going to be the missionaries to us, to teach our consumer-imprisoned society, our individualism that's created a lot of social problems that are real real problems that can be spoken to, by, I think, by some of these people. Now, one of the places where we might differ from more traditional societies is that it's always the case, almost always the case in traditional societies, that a male has a male child's birth that creates greater joy. It's not always the case. Sometimes when the daughter is born, it means more opportunity to gain from that child as the child gets closer to marriage. But in many traditional societies, the male child is more important because the male child has more clout with the spirit world and has more power in communicating and appeasing the spirits of the ancestors and the other spirits of their world. Usually the daughter in born to the family will eventually be given to the clan or the family of the husband. There are matriarchal societies where the opposite is the case, but in most it would be that the daughter would be given and become a part of the clan of the husband. And the fact of the male having more clout with the spirits, according to their traditions, is also a way of guaranteeing the good life after you die. If I have more male children, that when I die, they will have, my male children will have more power than my female children in communicating with other spirits and helping me along the path in my life after death. And I think we need to see some of those things in terms of polygamy, for example. The polygamy quite often is practiced to ensure the fact of the continuing presence of somebody who's going to remember me when I'm dead. And I have immortality as long as there are people who remember me and remember my name and speak it in prayer and thanksgiving and incantations and another way. So I'm going to make sure that I have as many after me as possible. Not only for social security in my old age, which is another reason for polygamy, that I have all these people who are going to care for me when I'm old and decrepit, but also that after I die, there are these people who are going to care for me. And so when people come along and say, well, polygamy is against the ways of God or whatever, it runs into a lot of conflict. The same would be true in relation to birth control. And there are places, there are countries, leaders of several African countries have tried to see the need for birth control and to slow down the population explosion, and have clinics dispensing birth control pills and so on and so on. But in some places it's met with some approval. But when all of your pressure, religiously, culturally, socially, works toward having more children, it becomes a very difficult task to convince people that less children is better. Why is it better? Everything else in my world says it's better to have more children, and the more the better. Maybe we can get back to that as another topic of conflict or dialogue between efforts that have come through Western missionaries and understanding of our world in traditional ways. In many cultures, there's a lot of rituals that have to do with birth and with the place of birth. And the placenta after the birth in many cultures is a kind of a symbolic separation of that child from the mother to the community, that with that point of contact biologically, physically to the mother has now been broken, that child is now a part of the community and not just a part of the mother. And in some places that the placenta is buried under a certain tree or near a tree, which becomes the child's tree or the family's tree, becomes again the holy place of the source, of the roots, and becomes also the place of burial for the person when the person dies. And they mentioned in an earlier session that that's one of the devastations of forced removals of people, such as taking place in South Africa, to move people away from their traditional burial places for economic or other reasons, is is a deed of real religious desecration. The child then becomes alive to the community. It's not that the relationship to the parents ceases, but it's not in the nuclear way in which we see it. The child often has many names in a lot of African societies, and usually names come at different times in their lives. And as Christians, there's quite often a time for the giving of a name, as we have it in the term christening, name giving. Names of relatives, other names that have to do with significant events at the time of birth, and some strange-sounding names to us as we think of some of those events about which people are named. It often happens that people change their names quite arbitrarily, and school personnel will often wring their hands with the fact of knowing who this kid is. You know, last year he was Joseph, and this year is David, and the year before that he was Ralph or something else, and you know, the name is changed for some significance in their life, but it's a little bit hard to keep a cumulative record in school of someone whose name keeps changing. Following birth, there's usually a time of a purification rite for the mother. And the mother is put into seclusion. It seems to me to be a bit of a contradiction that with birth and the coming of a child is such an event of pleasing quality for the community, that there should be a need of purification for the mother at this time. But it has a lot to do with blood and the symbolic meanings of blood in most African cultures' understandings. In some of the cultures, there's a built-in birth spacing, if not a birth control, and it's one of the things that people have used to incorporate what is seen as a good thing of less children with traditional ways in some tribes there can be no sexual intercourse during the time that a mother is nursing a child. And there have been efforts to try to encourage a longer period of nursing to make the spacing of the child a longer time. But among the Maasai people, for example, that they do nurse until the child's about 2 years old, so there's usually a natural spacing of at least that long a time between children. When we think about the passage of a young person into youth, into a more responsible part of their culture, into puberty, there usually is some kind of a traditional school. Education goes on all the time within a village, where the elders are teaching the young, usually by stories and also by proverbs, as we've mentioned. Some fantastic storytellers. And many of the storytellers even have some kind of a scoreboard, which has various notches and marks that indicate to them the stories. And stories that, as they've been recorded, can be seen that they're repeated almost precisely the same in the same words another time when they are repeated. There is a lot of contact with adults because societies are farming, subsistence farming, so there is a regular interplay. It isn't one of the parents commute somewhere and the child never knows what the parent's work is. You know, it's always a collective enterprise of family farming at its ultimate. There's a lot of regular contact with adults in the work, in the music, in the dancing, in the celebrating, in the times of feasting, in the times of fasting, the times of building houses, the time of celebrating the marriage, of death and burial, the rituals that go on, always includes the children. Together with that regular ongoing activity, there's usually in most tribes some kind of what is called bush school, where in bush usually refers to the wilderness or out or away or in the woods or the forest or somehow away from the place where people live. And there are certain people within the bush school that are the traditional teachers, that have the special knowledge, the special contact with the spirits. The teaching usually goes on separately for boys and for girls, a boys' bush school and a girls' bush school. And they are sometimes in the school for long periods of time, sometimes over more than a year, which there's no contact with the parents or with the rest of the family. And they are in the school, the food is brought, there's preparation, the people get together to prepare the food to bring to the school. And during the time, the children are taught what they need to do and to be as an adult, as the male and female roles are explained. Dances and songs are taught and stories, the traditions of the tribe, of the people, are ingrained in them. They're also taught pain. That pain is an experience of adulthood, and as part of the bush school they experience pain. Sometimes it's inflicted, either by various rituals of scarring, and you'll see often African people with various kinds of scars that have taken place during the rituals of bush school. A kind of stoicism is created and developed within people, within the young people during this time. So there's a combination of some of the pain of the bush school as well as the celebrating time. In terms of marriage, I think we're all well aware that in most of these traditional cultures, marriages are arranged. It usually becomes an agreement between clans or between families. It really isn't a matter that boy and a girl or a young man or a young woman rebel against not being able to make their own choice. I think, you know, most of us and most of our kids would think, you know, not too kindly about us as parents arranging who they would marry. Which again is a difference between an individualistic and a communal society. But in traditional cultures, it's very well accepted that this is what is going to take place. And it does not mean that love and romance are lacking. And it doesn't always mean that the people have no say in who the persons will be. But the arrangements are definitely made from family to family and not from individual to individual to make this choice. The two families then become united. And I think in our marriage services we make some recognition of that fact, but it's kind of passing recognition. The main focus within our culture of the marriage are the vows of commitment made by two people and the formation of a new nuclear family. And the celebrating of a marriage event in an African setting would be much more the corporate of the coming together of families. Virtually every person marries. And it's another reason for polygamy. For one reason or another, there tends usually to be more women than men. And polygamy is a way of dealing with that situation. If there were no polygamy in a lot of traditional cultures, the women would have no place. They would either be sent to wander, they would become slaves, or, and now as Western society has infiltrated more and more of the cities, they would go to the cities and become prostitutes. Prostitution is a tremendous problem and blight upon most African cities. So the polygamy helps to maintain the solid nature of the community. Marriage is intended for the purpose of children. And if there are no children, it really is not a complete marriage, and becomes another reason for polygamy. And if the real problem comes when it's the man's fault for the barrenness or the sterility, or the lack of bearing of children, the men would not admit it anyway. In most of the patriarchal society, some way or another, it's the woman's fault. But in polygamous situations, a woman would seek another man to have a child, either secretly to uphold the honor and the saving the face of her husband, to have a child, because that is essential both for her worth and for his. As this has come over into Christian churches, quite often in African settings, the church councils or the deacons or the elders, usually called the elders, have a tremendous say in who gets married in the church. And I don't think most of us, if we were to get elected to a church council here, would consider that part of our responsibility, is the arranging of marriages for people within the parish. But they are very much involved in the dialogue that goes on between families in arranging those those weddings. In some African cultures, the fact of a woman being a virgin at the time of marriage is extremely important, and becomes a day of rejoicing for both families if it is determined at the wedding day that she is in fact a virgin. In other cultures, a woman needs to be at least pregnant by the time of marriage to show that she's going to be a fit wife, that is, to be able to bear children. And both kinds of pressures operate in different places. A lot has been made about bride wealth or the money paid. You know, my wife was worth 3 cows and 2 goats, or you know, those kind of jokes that go on. And really, the bride wealth has as its purpose to thank the bride's family. It's a way of showing that she has value. And it's also done, the gift of something to the bride's family at marriage is a guarantee of fidelity, that the clan will do all of its part to assure the faithfulness. It's really not a price for the bride. It's not, you're not paying so much for, but it's an expression of thankfulness and a guarantee of fidelity. One of the places I think where we have a lot of conflict in our society, at least in present times, in traditional African ways, is that for the woman, the worth is always to bear a child. And taught that from early childhood, from role models, from the bush school, and all the way up, that the value of a woman is in childbearing. Some of the places where I've tried to suggest as we go along where this might have dialogue with Christianity, and where it has, as Christianity has confronted some of these aspects of community living in traditional societies, I think that we can look at Scripture and see a lot of community living in the Old Testament, the covenant community that formed around the Ten Commandments and other laws during the wilderness time, preparing the people to be a people before entering the Promised Land, where sin was really a sin against the community rather than an individualistic thing. In the New Testament, images of the body of Christ as the church, the corporate life of people together in Christ's love, I think have a lot of connections with such concepts of community living. Some of the issues I think have to do with such things as birth control. Can a person be a complete person without bearing children? The place of the male in traditional societies. Rituals that go around the time of purification of the mother. How does that relate to prayers and rituals that relate to baptism? In most adaptations of baptism in African situations, there's a blessing of mothers, and in some cases also of fathers, but a connection point between those traditions and the Christian traditions. There's been, in terms of bush schools and other passage rites into puberty, efforts to Christianize some of those schools and those events, putting Christian content or at least a Christian relationship to it. One of our missionaries in Liberia has developed a relationship with the Zoes, as they call them, Z-O-E, the traditional traditional healer, sorcerer, spirit liaison persons, where when the people come out of the bush school, he is there and has Christian prayer with the young people and with the parents. And the parents are all waiting, you know, like parents waiting for their kids to come home from summer camp and, you know, wondering if they in fact have survived the bush school, first of all, and the joy to see them come out of the gates made of bamboo fences and whatnot that enclosed the bush school, and the great celebration of parents being reunited with their children, of the clan being reunited. And he has gotten himself in by trust to be there to have Christian hymns and prayers with the families and with the children as they come out of bush school. Kind of an interesting link of the traditional ways. And maybe just a couple of things about death and that as a last rite of passage, in a sense. The myths and the stories in most African traditions deal with death, as we saw in the first session, deal with creation and the fall, the separation of people from the high God. But very few of them have a sense of resurrection in the end time, or a sense of reunion, and that the separation has been broken and solved from God's side. The sense of breaking in to history of the Christ and of a God that actively seeks in love is something that is welcomed often by people of traditional beliefs, because they live in a spirit world that is often oppressive and fearful. Here comes a stronger spirit force that is loving and receiving and welcoming and restoring. Well, maybe there are some things in all of this that have prompted your talk longer than I thought. Comments?
Go ahead, Matt. Earlier you talked about being ostracizing the punishment. Is that that enable the formation of families, plants, whatever you want to call it?
Well, it has, and in more modern times, when cities have cities have formed, you have cities full of displaced people. And a lot of times people have come to the cities simply to seek a better life, and they've been caught up in the glamour of advertising or consumer things and have left traditional ways. But a lot of them are people that have, for one reason or another, been forced out. So you don't always have cities full of the most desirable people. It's not totally the case, but a lot, and a lot of really tragic things about how women get there, where there's no place for women, and there's really no place in the city either, except in prostitution or in some other menial kinds of jobs.
My impression, in the past anyway, is that many times this led to virtual death, ostracized, treated as a non-person.
Yeah.
Ultimately led to their demise.
Yeah, very often it would, because you don't survive in the wilderness against either enemies or wild animals for very long. And that's, again, a concept of a town as a place of shelter. I think it's closer to the biblical understanding. For us, we've gone through this period where cities are evil. And you know, if you really want to be pure and holy, you come out to a place that's away from cities and towns. But in their concept, to come together into communities is a place of refuge and shelter. And to be ostracized is to be out there in the wilderness someplace where there is no one who would care for you, and you'd be prey to evil people or evil beasts.
Where are the fewer men than women?
I don't know, and I said that, I didn't even have it in my notes, I don't know if it's true. But there are very few societies that I know of where there are multiple husbands and one wife.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But all over there are polygamous with more than one wife families.
Not a lot of single males or no. Violence that accounts for it?
You know, maybe it's the violence, maybe it's the battles that have killed off the men, the fighting with neighboring tribes, or I'm not sure. That would be interesting to check in as to how there could be the imbalance where there are so many cultures that are polygamous.
I think that basically that there's fewer males born than females, and that could be due to just the sperm itself. The female or the female sperm is much more viable than the male sperm. Mm-hmm. And usually reaches the egg first and fertilizes.
Is this worldwide, this phenomenon?
Oh, well, yeah, sure. It would be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they always start out.
I've always been taught that there was not much difference, except that male babies are weaker when they're born, more of them die at birth. Do most of the Africans still live in a tribal setting rather than in cities?
The number of cities has grown remarkably in the last 15 years, in which there are some 30, 40 cities of well over a million people, and which is a real change of direction. The urbanization has really been a...
What's happening to the community in the cities?
It leaves people living in a very schizophrenic life, because in the cities they have encounter with music and literature and ways of another world, and people find themselves pull between the two cultures. The culture of the parents living back in the village, and the pull that they see of the changing way of life of the city. And it leaves people in a great deal of distress. You'll often see in cities really collections of villages, where you'll have people of one tribal area in one part of the city and another in another. But it's wearing down, and the loyalties and the traditions become less important as there's more intermarriage and more movement between. And, uh, much harder to see it in the cities. They might still have a loyalty, you know, they'd have language, and they would have some traditions that would linger. But as urbanization is really moving, it leaves people in a real quandary as to where they really live.
Are there entire communities at this point that have turned completely away from the traditional religions and become Christian communities?
Yeah, in fact, the growth of Christianity most often has come by large numbers, by ethnic groups, by clans, more so than by individual conversion.
I've been told a number of times that there's many more Lutherans in Africa than there is in the United States.
There aren't more Lutherans, but there are more Christians.
Okay.
And there will be, by the year 2000, Africa will be the continent with the most number of Christians of the continents. There are large groups of people. They don't necessarily always turn away from their traditional beliefs, but the traditional beliefs kind of feed into and Christianity kind of grows out of. And many of them, there is not a conscious total rejection of all of this, but a blending of their traditional ways into this new spirit of Christ, which is added to the spirit that already exists. There's conflicts that come with that, but it isn't like they would change from, you know, I totally turn my back on all of this and move to this, but a kind of an acceptance of the new faith is growing out of the reality they already enjoy.
Is it any different with us?
Is it any different with us? I don't know, is it? Or is that rhetorical?
Can you get a little more specific? For example, the more traditional Western Christian ethics and the examples you have given me. You gave one example where trying to Christianize some other Bush school. But how about, let's say, for the outcasts, throwing something as simple as forgiveness, that the outcasts would become part of their plan again? Or the polygamy marriage. That's what an ongoing debate, whether the scriptures prohibit polygamous marriage except for bishops who shall be the husband and one wife, etc. Any comments that you'd like to have there? Like forgiveness, like the marriage ethic, etc.
I think the forms of Christianity that have come to Africa vary as broadly as the forms of Christianity we have here or Europe. And so there would be a lot of different approaches to those kinds of questions. There are some, like with the forgiveness and the welcoming back of the outcast, some things that are strikingly different from the traditional ways, which would be a new way of thinking and new growth needed and a real conversion of thought needed. With polygamy, Christians have kind of gone between one end of the continuum and the other. Some who have said it is all right. Some have said no way. You either get rid of all but one or you do not become Christian. And then in between, most of the churches have accepted a position where people are accepted with the wives they have, but can't take any more. Or once you're a Christian, you cannot become polygamous. And it's that kind of middle ground that most of the African Christian churches have taken.
Which also means that, hopefully, that the Christian church helps define a new role for women then.
Yeah.
Or have they not done it?
I think there have been some efforts at trying, but it's certainly not at the same point it is here. In terms of equality, but it's growing. And in seminaries, for example, there are a lot of women students in African seminaries. Most churches don't ordain them yet, but a lot of the independent churches, the spiritual churches, there are women prophetesses and others where women have a part. There is a role there for them to grow into, but I would say that in the main, the mission efforts have been to try to assist women in their roles and to alleviate some of the burden. The women really carry the burden of Africa, vocationally, agriculturally, in almost every way. And there's a growing number of educated African women who are becoming much more vocal and adamant in writing and speaking on this. During this summer now, there's been the International Conference on the Decade of Women of the UN, which was in Nairobi, Kenya. And a lot of joining hands of people from all over the world, from various third world countries, from behind the Iron Curtain, from the so-called free world, joining together as women. But mainly I think that the effort has been to increase the general living conditions of people, rather than trying to say that this role for women is right or wrong. For example, to create a better situation, a better clean water, a better situation for childbirth and other situations that would refer to the general welfare of people, rather than taking a cultural view from the West and saying this should be your way of progress. I mean, we've made too many mistakes, I think, already about saying that our way is best for the world. We continue to do that with so-called development schemes, which most often don't work, with agriculture, a lot of times with medicine. And we have to, I think, work with the wisdom of the people themselves and not assume that we are the answer people.